Hello and welcome to edition 372 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll be discussing the concept of a 24-hour city. London's finally unveiled its night tube. We invite Matthew Beaumont, author of A Nocturnal History of London, and Alexi Duggins, the journalist and night out expert. How do you become one of those, Andrew, I wonder, to tell us what makes a city truly 24/7?
Then we'll be talking box office. It's been a tough year for Hollywood and a similar story in China. We crunch the numbers and discuss the possible reasons behind them with two critics who know their lazy sequel from their summer blockbuster.
And if you could nominate a UNESCO World Heritage site, where would you choose? Canadians are being given exactly that choice. We'll hear from the country's environment minister why she thinks it's a great idea.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Henry Rees Sheridan is back, oh yes, with his news look ahead right here on the Monocle Weekly. And that's on Monocle 24.
Another week bites the dust, Andrew. And here we are, Sunday lunchtime. It's the Monocle Weekly. Edition 372, did you say?
Talking of lazy sequels.
Come on now.
372 of them.
Everyone a gem in its own way. An imperfect gem, maybe, but polished, highly polished.
They've got some good topics for us this week. Talking about the nighttime economy. You're always in bed by nine. How are you going to talk about that?
Well, I'm contributing to the nighttime economy by recharging myself during those nighttime hours.
I'm trying to remember, who was it in the Monocle offices who got on the tube and woke up in Elmer's End?
There's so many candidates.
Was it you?
I'm pretty sure it wasn't me. I'm very well behaved.
I can't remember who it was.
I haven't really been out after dark since the late 1990s. So
I'm going to have to do a little bit of quizzing. I thought it was you that ended up in Elmer's End.
Sounds like something Tom Reynolds would have done.
You've never been in Elmer's End? Okay, well, we'll have to find out about that another time.
This is a high-quality family show, Andrew. Let's keep it lofty.
You've never been up Archway? I thought they were all your neighbourhoods.
I used to live around that neck of the woods. Moving on.
Frequented it.
This may prove beyond us, Andrew, but shall we try and raise the tone on the Monocle Weekly?
Oh no, it's Henry Rees Sheridan.
Henry Rees Sheridan, here he is. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thanks very much, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Well, and Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew. Yeah, but you addressed me.
Okay, but the welcome is from both of us.
I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
I like your training shoes, but has someone been wearing them as a slipper?
It's funny you should say that, Andrew, because this is actually a while back.
Is this the Monocle Weekly name and shame hour?
I'm not going to name him. I'm not going to name or shame him.
Oh, it's male. That's 50% of people written out of the possibles.
But, yeah, no, I suspect that one of my flatmate has been wearing my shoes, which I'm quite fond of, as slippers. So in the fashion of stepping on the back heel rather than actually inserting the foot into the whole shoe and crushing the... Is it the heel of the shoe? What do you call it? Just the back of the shoe.
It's got a reflective band on it, hasn't it?
The angle of the shoe, and has been misshaping the shoe. And this actually happened a while back, but for some reason my mind has returned to it. I do bear a grudge.
And I'm That's good news for our listeners everywhere.
And I'm quite kind of neurotic, so my mind's been going back there recently.
And I don't know why. What first alerted the footwear Miss Marple to this fact?
I could just tell. I knew it when I saw it.
Sixth sense.
Well, not really. Just the backs were folded in a bit.
I'd wear his pants as revenge.
Is that raising the stakes or is that an equal blow?
I'm not sure if that's a proportionate response. I'm not sure if I'd want to enter into that kind of dynamic of escalation either.
I've got a good joke about that, but it's reasonably long, so maybe I'll have to tell it after the news look ahead.
Maybe
we could do it like tall stories.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to say.
Joke of the week.
Yeah. Andrew's shaggy dog story.
It involves a pair of pants, but anyway.
Henry, where should we start?
We're going to begin on the island of Ventotene, I think it's pronounced as, in the Tyrrhenian Sea, where on the 22nd of August, the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, the French President François Hollande, and the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi are going to meet. That sounds nice, doesn't it? What are they going to discuss? Europe without Britain. Britain's not invited.
Well, that's fair enough,
and
isn't it?
It is completely fair enough. We shot ourselves in the foot. We didn't RSVP, did we? So they're going to be talking
what
about...
What kind of trilateral is it? Is it an agreeable lunch? Are they...
I'm not sure, but it is a. It seems to me to be an unusually scenic, quite intimate... The kind of place Monocle might write about.
I've never heard of that island.
Yeah, it's probably almost only because I'm pronouncing it incorrectly.
Does EasyJet fly there?
Where should we go next?
We're going to go to Russia. We're going to go to Russia for some vexillology.
What's that?
The study of flags.
Oh, I knew that. That's annoying. That's annoying. Because we even had the man on from
We've had some very good vexillologists.
I think, we have.
just flagging it up for you.
On the 22nd of August, 2016, National Flag Day is being marked across the Russian Federation. It's a very interesting history, the Russian flag history. For the first 500 years of its existence, the country didn't have a coat of arms or a national flag or an anthem. But in 1699, Tsar Peter the Great selected the white, blue and red tricolour, which was normally flown by merchant ships. I was just about to say something else then. Now, Tsar Nicholas I changed the colours of the tricolour to black, yellow and red. It's quite racy, isn't it, for a flag?
Well, I'll speak to Belgians and Germans about it.
Yeah. Which went on for a while, and then obviously with the communists, changed to the old hammer and sickle classic.
I thought they always had a bit of an eagle on there as well. Or was that kind of optional?
No, I think that's...
Eagle optional.
I think that's a coat of arms. I think that's optional. Right. And talking of vexillology...
They should have a bear on the flag, I think.
Let's bring in some vexillology.
We don't mean a fat gay man.
I wasn't thinking that for a second.
Genuine shock from Henry Sheridan.
That was... I'm looking at Fernando Pacheco behind the glass, so we produce.
No, just a thumbs up. Carry on.
And do you know what that would be called if there was a bear on the flag? Or
I'm not sure now.
It would be called a charge.
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. In vexillology terms.
Now, you were complaining to me the other day because your home nation of Wales is not represented on the Union Jack. Did you know that, Andrew?
I wasn't complaining.
That's a vexed issue for many Welshmen.
Oh,
come on, that's pretty good.
That was really good. I like the Welsh flag. I don't think it should be incorporated into the Union Jack. I think the Union Jack is one of the strongest flag designs out there. I don't think it should be tampered with. And I think that every proposed solution, including superimposing the dragon on the jack, is ugly.
Okay.
It shouldn't happen.
Time for one more?
I hope so. Between the 24th and the 26th of August, in the home country of Monocle 24's very own Marcus Hippie, Oulu, in Finland, the Air Guitar World Championship finals...
This is a classic annual event.
...are taking place. Now, I know this is something which obviously... It's lazy journalism to revisit this year on year.
From you, Henry, surely.
But I delved into the fine print. I actually visited the official championship website itself. Far from being a trivial knees-up, they actually have quite lofty ambitions. Since 1996, the Air Guitar World Championships, this is a copy from the website, has spread the peaceful message of air guitar across the world. According to the ideology of the air guitar, wars would end, climate change stop, and all bad things disappear. I would have thought the first two would have been collapsed into the third category there, but anyway, if all the people in the world played the air guitar.
What, in perpetuity, or just for a certain amount of time each day? Or
it doesn't stipulate how long they should play it for.
That's a good lesson for people, I think.
I'm not sure if it is a good lesson for people. I think that's quite wishful thinking.
Do you play the air guitar? Do I want to know the answer to that?
I play both wooden and metal and air guitars.
Oh, very good.
As is my one.
What would be your favourite air guitar track?
God, I really have to think about this. What would yours? I'm gonna throw that question back at you. We have quite similar tastes in rock and roll,
don't we? Bit of Zeppelin, something like that.
Bit of Zeppelin, nothing wrong with that.
I imagine that's probably regularly features at the Air Guitar World Championships.
Andrew?
The Nolan Sisters.
Classic.
They're very good on air guitar.
Are they?
Yeah. Some of their rockier numbers.
Yeah.
I'll do one of their rockier numbers.
I would pay
limitless sums of money to attend the Air Guitar Championships when Andrew Tuck makes his debut. I don't know if we can make that happen. Let's give it our best shot.
I'm not sure if I can go anywhere from there either. I might draw a line under that.
Let's draw a line in the sand and cross it no more. Thank you very much, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
After years of discussion, planning, controversy,
and industrial action too. The 24-hour tube is finally up and running here in London. What will this mean for the city? Are we finally on track to be a proper grown-up 24-hour city?
Well, to try and answer that question, we're joined in the studio by Matthew Beaumont, author of Nightwalking, A Nocturnal History of London, and by the journalist, Time Out editor-at-large and general night owl, Alexei Duggan. So welcome to you both. Thanks for being with us. Matthew, as I'll start with you, it is interesting, as a chronicler of a great history of London by night, what does this new chapter, see what I've done there, how's it likely to read, do you think, for the city?
Well, in some ways, I don't think it's going to change much because there's been transport at night. I mean, obviously, the night buses mainly for some time. But there's also been a 24-hour economy for centuries, not just decades. And no doubt it will contribute to that and it'll inflect it in various new ways. But I don't think it'll substantially alter the way in which the night is lived and thought in London.
Alexei, is a tube going to change the way that we behave in the city? I also almost wondered the other day whether it's come a little bit late, because when you look at most of the kind of people in our office who are in their 20s, they have got very firmly involved in the world of taxi apps and taxi sharing, and they've already found cheaper ways to stay out late at night. But do you think it is going to kind of mark how we change and live in the city?
I think it's an interesting one. It's not a development, I think, that on its own will be able to change how we live in the city. I mean, obviously, just sort of the closest example I can think of is the 24-hour licensing thing that was brought in however many years ago under the last Labour government, which was supposed to completely change our social life and just didn't, because we didn't have the transport infrastructure to go with it. Now we've got the transport infrastructure that will allow us to do it, but I wonder whether the licensing might affect that a little bit.
This week in Time Out, you've done a great piece where you've kind of gone around the city talking to people who kind of use the city already at night. There has been some questions in recent years that, you know, the perhaps changing tastes, you know, the world of the super club disappeared, you know, house music changed. Are we going out as much at night, or is it just we're going out in a kind of different way? We're going to smaller venues these days, do you think?
I mean, I certainly hope we're going out as much at night, otherwise I'm going to be redundant pretty soon. But I think we are. I think there is a real change in the habits of people. So obviously we all know about the problem that's happening with nightclubs. You know, I think the statistics, something like 2005, there were 3,100 in London. It's sort of gone down by 50% over the last decade, three this week. Already sort of looking a little bit iffy in terms of their future. But my feeling is that what correlates to that is there's been a rise in venues based around activities that aren't dancing to incredibly loud music. So your sort of your ping pong bars and such like, you know, your funky dance bars.
I like a funky dance bar. I think Tom, you could do that as well.
I thought you could say, I think Tom needs a bit of that.
Funky dance bar.
A dance bar?
Oh, yeah, yeah, dance is funky now.
If there's arrows involved, I'll be right there. But it's interesting, though, Matthew, on the sort of social side, again, you know, to pick up on the themes that you looked at in your book, going right back through, you know, whether it's like the London of Chaucer or Shakespeare and through, what about a social chapter that's maybe a bit different? People have already talked about, the tube will become this interesting new social hub. I guess people who've been on night buses and similar will probably think, not a hub I want to attend. But do you think there could be a part of that as well?
I think it will. There will be social changes. And I think that, for example, with lots of people, as you've been saying, using taxi apps and that kind of thing, that it will become, again, a place for erotic encounter, the tube. It's true to say that the night buses, I don't think, have ever been particularly famous for their kind of erotic encounters.
Well, the trouble was, you used to meet somebody, then you'd get on the bus and there'd be that very bright light and you'd be thinking, how do I get off at the next stop?
That's absolutely true. I don't feel we're selling, you know, to your international listeners, I don't think we're selling, you know, London as a 24-hour city, are we? So there's a certain potential there, I think. I mean, you know, London at night has always, like other metropolitan cities at night for centuries and centuries, been a site of erotic encounters, and people have used new technologies, including lighting, including modes of transportation, to sort of reconfigure their sex lives, to reconfigure the way in which classes are related to one another socially, are kept apart or converge with one another. So no doubt there will be some kind of change.
And Alexei, there's kind of cash in this change as well, isn't it? The nighttime economy is worth a lot to the city. And when we talk about employment and jobs for people who are moving to the city, you know, working in bars, working in restaurants, all the other businesses that stay open at night, it's an important part of London's metabolism.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that is irrelevant to the fact that Sadiq Khan has talked about appointing a night czar or night mayor. Maybe nightmare is not the right term to use. Doesn't make it sound that attractive. But yeah, it's a massive economy. And, you know, London is the thriving capitalist city. And where there is an opportunity to make more money, it will take it. So I think it will change the city. I think there's, you know, there's a bright future for night owls out there.
And just on that point of business, we already talked about the thriving economy. But I wonder how well, Matthew, you think that the city does function, how joined up that thinking is. It is interesting. We don't have a night mayor. You know, they have one in Amsterdam who's been on Monaco 24 before. And it's an interesting idea. You know, do you think there's a lack of joined up thinking when it comes to how the nighttime economy specifically functions in this country?
I think it's always developed unevenly and piecemeal. There's never been a plan in particular. I suppose now that there might be with the new night czar, an attempt to systematise, an attempt to promote certain kinds of activity. No doubt money-making ones are above all.
Is it the better for the fact that it hasn't been like that? I think it has grown in this more organic way?
I'd say that about London itself, not just London at night, that it's one of its great strengths is that it's this, you know, piecemeal accumulation of architectural styles, of social classes. There's nothing ordered or coherent about it, and its gloriousness lies in its sort of higgledy-piggledy-ness and chaos, really.
And Matthew, just tell us about that division between night and day. You know, a couple of hundred years ago, when, you know, lighting was difficult, when the city was a very different place, going out at night was seen as very nefarious. And that kind of has hung on for a long time. Now, if we have like kind of easy access to tubes and everything kind of functions throughout the night, there's something about the night that is, as you say, it's about sex and it's about kind of misbehaviour and it's about being able to be different when the dark falls. Do we risk losing some of that if it becomes very simple? And what was it like in the past when you went out at night?
I think we do risk losing some of that. For centuries and centuries, the day has, as it were, colonised the night. The daytime economy has colonised the culture of the night. And there have been various sort of signal shifts over the course of those centuries, one of the most obvious and dramatic being the introduction of public lighting in the late 17th century. And over the course of the 18th century, the century following, the emergence more and more of a kind of culture of shopping in the evenings after dusk and of promenading and of pleasure gardens and coffee houses and that kind of thing. But I'd say that despite the fact that that did transform the night, despite the fact that it illuminated the night and that it subjected the night to, as it were, the regime of enlightenment and capital, that a kind of moral curfew persisted, a sense that from the authorities' point of view, that the night had to be policed quite rigorously because persistently, in spite of these illuminations, in spite of the changing face of the night, people did use the night to transgress, and the night attracted, and the darkest places in the city attracted the most nefarious types, the vagrants, the sex workers, etc.
And Alexei, in a way, some of that hasn't changed now. It's amazing when you've these days, unfortunately, I'm probably on my way home rather than seeing people going out and joining them. But on the way home, you see people going out for the night. It's midnight. They dress differently. They behave differently. They hang out together differently. There's something glorious that happens when darkness falls. You cover this world of clubs and bars and you know it well. Are you still, entertained and surprised by these kind of pockets of pop culture that kind of spring up that you kind of don't see so clearly in the daylight?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a sense of adventure to the nighttime that does lend itself to people doing quirky, putting on quirky sort of crazy events. I mean, we've had our first naked restaurant, the world's first naked restaurant, I believe, a few months ago, which we're all very excited about, obviously. And yeah, the, I mean, there is that sense for sure of adventure and new things popping up. But I do wonder whether the authorities have ever really gotten out of that sense of there being something a little bit other about the nighttime, and whether it's a little bit naughty and shouldn't be encouraged.
Maybe. Yeah, because we've seen it, in, you know, not in London, but I know in we have many Aussies who work here in the building, and they always cite what's happened in Sydney, where there was a kind of a real concern about kind of brawling as bars closed. So they've cracked down so heavily on the kind of the drinking laws there. It's impossible to buy alcohol from an off license, as it were, after a certain time, and they don't allow people to enter bars after 1 o'clock. But they've said it's taken the fun out of the city, and it is the authority being scared of people's behaviour at night. And that is, I guess, the bit that you've come to in Time Out, is kind of saying this needs to be celebrated. This is kind of revenue. This is kind of culture. This is so many other things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that when we're on our deathbeds, many of us will be lying there going, let me tell you about these fantastic nights I had in my 60s where I used to turn the television off about 10 o'clock and go to bed quite early. I think what people will be talking about are those nights out when they were young and they, you know, they grabbed life with both hands and went out and stayed up till dawn, because that's, you know, that's the sort of stuff that makes us feel great. You know, these are adventures, and that, you know, there's nothing wrong with adventuring. Hey, I think adventuring is to be encouraged, personally.
Oh, we do too. We do too.
Well, everyone signs up to that. I just wondered briefly, in terms of where London should look maybe for inspiration, and Matthew, I don't know, again, looking at the, you know, your book and how you look at the city in which you do live, I think that's correct, you're in London.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Do you look elsewhere? You know, New York's the city that never sleeps, supposedly. We've got Amsterdam, which with its nightmare. You've got other cities like Berlin, for example, that are sort of renowned for the way they incorporate their night into their the rest of the day. It's just part of a day. It doesn't seem to have that differentiation. Do you think there are cities where London should be looking, I don't know, for sort of moral leadership on that question of the moral curfew that you raised earlier?
It's a really difficult question to answer. I mean, I think a lot of cities probably do have much livelier nightlifes than London does. I mean, what London really has to do is take a deep look at itself, I think, and maybe the fact that there's a new mayor and a nightmare too means that that's now possible again. But in particular, I think it has to look at the whole issue around gentrification and about where that's taking London and about how it's in some ways cleansing the city, places like Soho, not just the East End of London, where it's cleansing them socially in some respects, the way in which it's domesticating what was in the past and often kind of wild and wonderful nightlife. So personally, I don't think the prospects are that great. I mean, it's ironic in a sense that that this effort to provide an impetus for the nighttime economy, which the night tube is giving a boost to, it comes at precisely the time when nightlife is changing in I think rather negative ways in places like Soho, is being gentrified and tamed.
Well, Alexei, perhaps let's try and finish on an upbeat note. what do you think we should cling on to here then? Obviously, these are the transport's very much kind of arteries of a city. I think Matthew makes a very, very compelling case, but you know, could it re-energise a bit more oxygen into those arteries, having this kind of transport? Are you optimistic about what it holds?
Yeah, I am optimistic. As I say, London will find a way if there's a way to make money. And the emails that we're seeing at Time Out are already bars talking about new initiatives. I mean, a lot of that are sort of, someone's putting on a cocktail that's blue because it looks like the Victoria Line, so they're not amazing.
Sign me up for that.
Yes, sounds delicious, doesn't it? All those blue drinks, notoriously delicious. But yeah, I think there's a world of opportunity. We're seeing places that are starting to try opening a little bit later to capitalise on it. And, you know, let's not forget that it's only two tube lines that are opening at this point. When the whole thing opens, it could be a real game changer, I think.
Well, after a grumpy start to the summer with Brexit, it's quite nice to kind of, exactly, say, kind of kick up the backside for London. Alexei and Matthew, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Time for some music now. Today is the last day of the Summer Olympic Games in Rio. To mark the occasion, let's hear the new single from Brazil's biggest superstar of the moment. This is Anitta with Sim Ao Nao.
diversão. Mas a minha intenção não vou dizer. Só vai saber se quiser jogar.
Oh, that's a great track for a Sunday, Andrew. That was Brazilian singer Anitta with Sim. Oh no. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24 devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The Cinema Show on Monocle 24 in association with MUBI, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time. Because life is too short for bad films.
For all of Paris's vibrancy, its story is best evoked in the places where time just marched on past. To find them, you'll have to take the rue less travelled, just like the artists and thinkers who made the city famous. This is where the Monocle Travel Guide to Paris steps in. We've cut through all the touristy noise to uncover the lesser-known gems that we feel embody the essence of the French capital. To watch our film celebrating the 10th edition of the Monocle Travel Guide series, head to monocle.com et voilà.
Now, Canada is well known for its epic, beautiful landscape and the cultural landmarks that sit within it, be they natural wonders or man-made places. The country is home to no fewer than 18 UNESCO World Heritage Sites, and next year that number looks set to grow.
The government's currently inviting the country's citizens to nominate new additions to the World Heritage Site list, and those new nominations will be announced next year to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Canadian Confederation. A little earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to Catherine McKenna, Minister of Environment and Climate Change, and the person responsible for parks in Canada, about the nation's wealth of wonders.
Tom began by asking how to separate locations of national interest from those that are simply, well, quite interesting.
Minister McKenna, thank you so much for talking to us on Monocle 24. We are today talking about a huge part of the national identity of Canada, in a sense. I mean, it's both natural and it's historic sites, which every few years are nominated to become World Heritage Sites for UNESCO. Tell us what's a little bit different about what's been going on this time around and how that's going to affect Canada's 150th year celebrations next year.
Well, I was really, really excited to announce that for the first time in 10 years, we're going to be taking nominations from all Canadians across the country for UNESCO World Heritage Sites. And as everyone knows, around the world, Canada is known for its natural beauty. So everything from the Rockies, which are already on the World Heritage List, to the Rideau Canal, another place in my riding of Ottawa Centre, an amazing feat of engineering and the world's longest skating rink. We're going to celebrate it. And we're going to make the announcements of the selections in 2017. So it's a great way to celebrate Canada's 150th birthday.
And I think something that's really interesting about the UNESCO World Heritage Sites is that there isn't that distinction between, say, perhaps a natural wonder and then something that has been built by civilized human communities. How do you sort of differentiate between what's a real site of interest and that needs to be preserved and what's one of just pure interest? Is there a difference there?
Well, I think there is a difference, although, of course, we're interested in hearing from Canadians across the country and also highlighting our Indigenous history and culture, because I think that there's certainly more we can do in that regard. But we're looking for, you know, the most outstanding achievements in Canada, as well as our most inspiring creations. So I was just this summer in Haida Gwaii, an amazing, incredible place off of the Queen Charlotte's. And it was just amazing to see Skagway, which is in 1960. 19th century Haida village, where they have remains of large cedar longhouses that are together that tell the history of the Haida society. And it's just incredible to be there. And so that's an amazing example where you see the natural beauty. So it's in the rainforest in some beautiful, beautiful waters. But you also see the history of the Haida people, and it tells the story of their society. And so, you know, you can actually combine both. But as you say, I mean, it's going to be hard. I'm really excited about this. And we're going to see some amazing suggestions from coast to coast to coast. We also have amazing places in our Arctic. And I'm really excited about the opportunity to highlight our beautiful Arctic. I'm also minister responsible for tackling climate change. And so, you know, we're concerned about the impacts of climate change. And we really want to highlight the natural beauty of the Arctic and also the people that are there. So it's just a really exciting time. And it's a great way to get Canadians involved and also tell the story to the world. Because I know that people come from all over the world to come visit Canada, that they love, you know, our natural beauty. They love hiking and skiing and swimming and seeing bears and eagles and also finding out more about Canada's history. So it's a great opportunity.
And it's a very interesting role that you have as the minister in charge of the environment and climate change. Do you feel that preservation in general is something that all Canadians should be thinking about every day, not just for these big decisions that come up maybe once in a decade? I mean, is that something that you're trying to enforce as a minister, an openness to preserving the environment in everyday actions? You know, is that something that you factor into your role?
Absolutely. So right now, I'm responsible for helping to develop our Canadian plan to tackle climate change. And our protected areas, our parks, are all part of the piece of the puzzle. We need to be doing more to protect our environment. It can be small actions like, you know, using less plastic bags or turning down the air conditioning where it's really hot right now, to actually looking at how do we protect and preserve more of our natural beauty. And that's also one of my priorities, that I am tasked with looking at how do we expand the protected areas and how do we expand our national parks. So working hard in that too. And but you know what? Canadians care. They care so much about the environment. And in the summer, it's a great time. Everyone's out in the national parks. They're in their local parks. They're getting out in the water. I just came over the bridge and I saw people canoeing in the Ottawa River. I mean, people love our natural beauty. And so it's something to celebrate, but it's also a really important part of the piece. If we're going to tackle climate change, we need to be making sure that we're very mindful about our impact on the environment.
And of course, Canada is a signee of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, which itself is a global issue. But when you're looking abroad across the world, are you aware that Canada's landscape and its natural assets are a real sort of power play card when you're spreading the country's image abroad?
Absolutely. I think I'm the biggest champion for Canada and our national parks and our national historic sites. It's certainly the story of Canada. People, I think a lot of people around the world, when they think about Canada, they think of mountains, they think of lakes, they think of the Arctic, they think of the natural beauty. And now my goal is to really encourage them to come here and see it and get more Canadians out into our national parks. One of my priorities is to get new Canadians out, to get Canadians that maybe not have had the opportunity to get out and enjoy the outdoors, to get young people out, because we really are so fortunate in Canada. We have a huge country, but it's also so incredibly diverse, and some parts of it are absolutely unspoiled. And that's really important. We need to be protecting it. And so I'm certainly a champion. When I go abroad, I encourage everyone to come to Canada. And next year, it's free access to national parks, historic sites, and marine conservation areas. So never a better time to come.
What are some of the more interesting nominations that you've been hearing, which perhaps maybe you weren't even aware of were so treasured by Canada? Have you been hearing any unusual suggestions?
Well, you know what? I've been hearing lots of suggestions. I'm going to try to stay out of it. But it's interesting because, as I say, I was all the way in Haida Gwaii on our west coast and just came back this week from Cape Breton Island, which is also absolutely gorgeous, hoping to get up to the Arctic. So there's certainly no shortage. And as you said, it's also outstanding achievements. So as I said, the Rideau Canal, it's a 19th century canal that's 202 kilometers long and the world's longest skating rink. So we really, you know, there's an opportunity to really think outside the box and celebrate our history and tell our story.
I believe there's a vote from some of the Canadians at Monocle to nominate the Trans-Canada Highway. Is that a suggestion that you guys are maybe considering?
Well, I'd never thought of the Trans-Canada Highway. I'm willing to hear all suggestions from coast to coast to coast.
I also wanted to just talk about some of the current outstanding areas of Canada. And one of the most recent is an area called Mistaken Point. I wonder if you can tell me the background to the name of that place.
Well, Mistaken Point is really amazing. It's on the southern tip of Newfoundland's Avalon Peninsula. It's very remote. And there were fossils that were found hundreds of millions of years ago. And it's really where the first appearance of fossils, you know, large organisms. So it's the idea when life got really big. So a big event in the evolution of life on Earth. So it's just one of those places that we need, you know, Mistaken Point. I think that's actually a big draw for people. So I'm hoping that we can get people to come out and see it.
Another one that jumped from the page, and again, there will be a very significant historical tale, I'm sure, behind it, but Head Smashed in Buffalo Jump. But that's a fantastic name for a place. How did that place get its moniker?
Well, it's where the Blackfoot killed their prey by chasing them over a precipice. So we could found carcasses were later found in the camp below. So you have huge burial mounds that have layers of bison bones below the cliff. And there's really representing nearly 6,000 years of use of the buffalo jump by the indigenous peoples of the Northern Plains. And as I said, like, this is all part of our story. In particular, the story of our indigenous peoples, we need to be doing a lot more to be telling the story and to be educating Canadians, but also the whole world, because that really is the story of Canada. And so, as you say, a great name. We've got Mistaken Point, we've got Head Smashed in Buffalo Jump.
They're fantastic. How often does this UNESCO conversation come up? I mean, do you think that this conversation needs to be had more often, or do you think that more high-profile prizes, such as the UNESCO World Heritage Site nominations, should be entering the Canadian conversation more, because it does have this wealth of natural and human-made achievements, which, if they're not preserved, they won't be there for future generations. I mean, do you think that these kind of celebrations of Canada's identity should be more welcome and more prevalent and more often?
Absolutely. I mean, it's amazing to see the interest right now amongst Canadians to nominate amazing natural and historic wonders. And we do need to be doing it more often. And I think we need to be celebrating our history and our natural beauty more than we do. Sometimes Canadians can be quite humble, but we have an incredible country. And this is a really great way to get all Canadians excited, from kids to like world experts. And we want to hear from all of them. And, you know, whether or not you make the World Heritage List, I mean, it's going to be hard. We're going to have a huge competition. It's also just a great way to look outside your back door and say, what is really inspiring me in Canada? What do I really want? What story do I want to tell about where I live?
Minister McKenna, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
That was Catherine McKenna, Minister of Environment and Climate Change and Minister responsible for Parks in Canada, in conversation with Monocle's Tom Hall. This is the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Now, to end the show this week, it's time now to discuss why this year's box office is down, both in the US and China, after a record-breaking year in 2015. Can we blame lazy sequels for it?
Well, to discuss the challenges facing the industry, we welcome film critics and Monocle 24 regulars Anna Smith and Tara Judah. Welcome both to the Monocle Weekly. If we look at travails industry-wide, numbers a bit disappointing, is it as easy as saying, oh, you know, too many weak sequels? Tara, we'll start with you. Is it more complicated than that?
I think it's definitely more complicated than that. I think that you have to look at, one, the whole industry as a broader ecology. So that works across from production, pre-production, into distribution, into exhibition. You've got to look at the entire way that the fabric of the film industry knits together. And that is, in one part, you know, these films have been planned for a long time. They start projecting what they're going to play for summer next year, the year after, and 5 and 10 years in advance. So the kind of plan for this is not something that's responding to what's happening contemporarily. But at the same time, I don't think it's necessary that you could say it's just the fact that there's sequels or we've seen this all before. I mean, that is what a blockbuster is. It is the formulaic, tried and true kind of a three-act structure, something, you know, that people can get a laugh out of or a tear. And it goes for those, you know, those heartstrings. But the thing about blockbusters is they've just been spending more and more money. So it's the production costs that are going up. And we have this issue of then, if production costs are going up, then the return on investment must be a lot higher, which means that the box office figures they have to smash are set much higher too. So that's only, I mean, one of many issues, I think, that feed into this problem.
So we're looking at some of the films here that flopped majorly, it says here, and I'll agree with this. This is Independence Day Resurgence, Alice Through the Looking Glass, Zoolander 2. I quite enjoyed Zoolander 1, but I had no desire to see number 2. And Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows. That roll call of films. What's interesting is, you know, there's nothing, I am a cinema guy, there's nothing there that would pull me in. Is it because, in a way, they've also become, we know they're formulaic, but they've become so diluted that actually they're not really connecting with any market in some senses, I wonder?
Well, I think the case with several of those is they were very late. You know, it was very late to have a Zoolander sequel. I mean, there was some interest. Films like that, you do have a certain guaranteed market, and that's it is a bit of a lazy option, because it's like, okay, there are a certain amount of people that whatever the critics like us say are going to show up and they're going to see Zoolander 2, even if they think it's probably going to be a bit rubbish and even if we tell them it's rubbish. But beyond that, it really starts to drop off, and the quality doesn't seem to have been as high this year generally. I mean, it's hard to generalise. But for me, I haven't enjoyed many of the films that were listed there personally, and audiences seem to have responded accordingly.
I was just going to say the other thing. I went to see a film which isn't actually on here, which I believe has done actually rather well at the box office, which is the new Bourne film, and was like so brokenheartedly disappointed, because, you know, I think back like 10 years ago or 8 years ago, this was being touted as a rival. Would it be the end of Bond? Because it was so clever, it was so contemporary. It's a film in which, you know, Jason Bourne says 244 words throughout the entire film, because it's apparently also aimed at the Chinese box office. It's like one long chase. And I wonder if lots of people just go into the cinema thinking, you know, even some of these things that they've invested lots of time with and learning to love are kind of not looking after them in a way. A bit like American TV series, they have to get ramped up more and more. So by the time you go and see all these sequels, they're so diluted. Maybe Tara, you'd like to pick that up.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that something has legs means that it has a life for a long time, which is what the studios pick up on. They think, okay, we've got Matt Damon, he's a huge star, he's on the rise, we've got this great formula. It obviously didn't work when they put Jeremy Renner in the film before. That did quite terribly. And so they think, all right, we'll bring Matt Damon back and we can, you know, revive this franchise. And I think to some degree that works in terms of box office, in terms of people going to the cinema, and you actually get a turnout. But any franchise is going to eventually disappoint its fans. I mean, the thing is that you're building an expectation with any franchise. You have a following insofar as they will go and see the films that they've already committed to, particularly when we think about films like The Hunger Games, the Allegiant films, the Divergent series, all of those ones where it's sort of like, we know they're in parts, we're going to go see the next one because we've already made the commitment. But at some point, I think, you know, if you look back at all the James Bond movies, even diehard James Bond fans think there are one or two of those that aren't particularly good, or there's a, you know, a Bond that they don't like as much as someone
else.
Sure,
but I wonder if you now put Skyfall against the latest Bourne movie, you know, you wouldn't, you'd be hard pushed to say that Bourne was going to threaten the idea of a franchise for Bond anymore. It's funny how they do, you know, it makes you realise, yes, Bond has lost its way over time, but that is hard work, you suddenly realise, keeping that franchise going for so many decades.
It absolutely is. I mean, I think keeping anything alive for a long time is really difficult. And that's probably why they tried to put Jeremy Renner in the role, because like Bond, they, you know, reinvigorate the franchise regularly by having a new star, by trying to take it in a new direction. And look, sometimes that's successful and sometimes it isn't. And sometimes it's successful in terms of maybe the audience like it and the critics don't. I think what we're seeing is that, you know, perhaps in the Jason Bourne example, is that it's pretty much flatlining across the board. It still did okay at the box office, though. I think it's interesting that domestically in the UK, it actually in the last week didn't do as well, and neither did Finding Dory as an art house film, Wiener Dog, which is just out on, you know, kind of local picture houses release. So there are audiences that aren't willing to go along to see it.
Just on that point that Andrew sort of made tangentially about Bourne, saying it's kind of a dialogue-free zone and that helps with selling and distributing the picture in China, those numbers are quite striking. Especially 2015, there was like 50% growth. It was an astonishing place. The market contracted by 5%. Box office dropped quite a lot, ducked below $700 million. Do you think that whatever these other worries are for traditional Hollywood, the fact that the Chinese market, on which they've staked quite literally so much, will that worry even some of the big studios, do you think, Anna?
They'll certainly pay attention to it because the Chinese market is becoming absolutely huge and a great consideration. But I think it is a bit early to say. I mean, this is just one summer, you know, and we haven't looked at the full picture of the year. We've got, you know, another Star Wars film coming out later in the year. The year as a whole could actually pick things up. But as a summer, I think it has been a bit tired all round.
Now, I can't claim, Anna, this is going to chew into the Zoolander audience. But I also wonder for the kind of liberal middle class people that probably listen to this radio station, that, you know, Netflix, for example. Now, if I go around the office, the one thing in the last 3 or 4 weeks every single person has spoken about is not a movie. It's, have you seen Stranger Things? What episode are you on? How have you caught up? Now, I sat down and I watched that in two chunks. And so effectively, you're watching two movies worth of content. And I wonder if, people who, you know, have Netflix or are diving into that TV on demand, that it is also going to threaten some of that audience for certain films, do you think?
I think Netflix is good and bad for cinema, actually. I think on the good side, what it's doing is making people more adventurous and they're actually exploring and looking at documentaries, you know, feature-length documentaries that they might not have otherwise done. And they're experimenting and then they end up going to the cinema to see more documentaries in future. But on what you said, yes, of course. I mean, it's a massive competitor. You know, people have busy lives, they have children. It's a lot easier to sit down and watch something on Netflix as it is than it is to go to the cinema. And the quality of TV is very, very high at the moment and they're putting a lot of money into it and episodic material. So I certainly know people in the film industry that are a little bit worried about it, financially speaking, because a lot of money's going that way.
And Tara, that same question for you in a way, that water cooler moment, which a movie needs, it's like, you know, the buzz around it. And again, you know, I can't claim to be speaking for kind of like 16-year-olds or for certain kind of demographics. But again, for people like us in the room, it is strange, isn't it? Something like Stranger Things has caught people's imagination more or been talked about more than any of these movies.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing that Netflix have been doing recently, which is incredibly smart, so one is that, you know, they already made themselves a major stakeholder and a major player at international film festivals. They go to Berlin and they buy like nobody's business, you know, and they've inflated the market in that sense and they've actually made it harder for some other people to go in and buy some of that product. So they've kind of created this new ecosystem where they're really calling a lot of the shots. And the fact that they're putting money into production and creating their own product, and that is one thing that theatrical can't do, because the thing about theatrical distribution is that we have to remember that it's the only thing that is separating it right now is that it still has that 120-day window for all the big blockbusters, is that they don't go to home entertainment, they don't go to video on demand until 120 days after their release. But Netflix is changing that model, and it's not so much things like, you know, Mubi or Fandor or BFI Player or all these other online streaming sites that are really getting in the way of that. It's Amazon Prime and it's Netflix, and that's because they really know what they're doing. They're bringing out their own content in a way that is, you know, really captivating an audience. You know, and it's something that I think theatrical can't compete with because they don't have that product to offer you at home on that day and date. I mean, we are seeing the window close in the art house world, but I think in terms of blockbusters, it's just going to stay that way. And just bear in mind that the costs of a blockbuster are so much higher than the sorts of stuff that Netflix are producing.
Well, I want to sort of pick up on a point there that's kind of a corollary to that. And I wonder, Anna, if I can ask you about it. I've seen a number of actors and some directors even saying, this is great. I love making a Netflix series because I get to pick apart an extraordinary narrative, dynamics, a character. I get to develop it over 8, 10, 12 hours. I'd never get to do that on the screen. And I wonder, I mean, from the directors, the actors that you speak to, do you hear that message as well, actually, as an artistic challenge, it delivers something more?
I think when I interview these people, they tend to spin it, you know, depending what they're actually talking about. So there's an element of that, you know, they're pros.
Surely not.
But also, yeah, I think, of course, it's a wonderful opportunity for an actor to be able to really, really work on a character over that period of time. And because they're now working with really strong writers and directors, and also I hear a lot from, you know, women in the field that it is easier to get strong, meaty roles in TV and in streaming films because there are fewer risks involved, there are fewer advertisers involved, there's fewer studios involved, so there are kind of more interesting and creative risks being taken with the likes of Transparent, for example.
And Tara, you know, the other strange thing about this is, you know, that we know that screenings are done well in advance before these movies come out, and they have an ability to recut, even refilm endings of films. why are they getting it wrong? Are they listening to the wrong people? Or, as you say, is it just that so much money gets invested in a way the juggernaut can't be stopped at a certain point?
Well, I mean, I think that there is something to be said for looking at the types of films that came out this summer. And in a sense, Zack Snyder's name is attached to two of them. One as director and one as executive producer. So that's the David Ayer's film and Suicide Squad. So, you know, we've had these two movies where we've sort of got the Batman versus Superman as well. So we've got Zack Snyder, who's, you know, really, in my opinion, not a great filmmaker. And yes, he's got a lot of money and studio support behind him, but it also, you have to think about, you know, who is the test audience and then who is the general audience. And I think maybe sometimes that the studio world kind of, it's its own its own little system where it kind of doesn't really understand what the rest of the world want. And sometimes we don't want the product that they're putting out.
Perhaps we should ask you both, you know, we need to kind of give people a bit of a spring in their step. When you look across the next few months of the year, are there things on the horizon that you're excited about seeing, whether blockbuster or mini-buster? Anna, what would you be looking out for?
Well, the good news is when summer ends, award season pretty much starts. So you get some really high quality indie movies and dramas and films I've enjoyed that are coming up in September onwards are kind of Captain Fantastic, Viggo Mortensen, a lovely creative film about a hippie dad, and then Hunt for the Wilder People, which has been a sleeper hit in the New Zealand, and it's coming over here, Sam Neill. So I'd watch out for those.
Yeah, I'm also really looking forward to the next Star Wars movie. I think that they've actually done a good job with their latest film, and I hope high hopes for the rest of the franchise. And I think Rogue One could potentially be a blockbuster that actually, you know, hits the mark.
There we go. That's what we like. We like to end on
a positive. Yeah, that's good. Way. I'm going to the cinema again.
Perfect stuff. Tara Judah and Anna Smith, thank you both very much for coming to see us on the Monocle Weekly. Andrew, edition 372 of the Monocle Weekly passes by.
We enjoyed that, didn't we?
Like tears in the rain. What a great show that was. Particularly interesting. Londoner's 24-hour city, the travails of the movie business, and even a bit of World Heritage Site action for good measure.
And Henry Lewis Sheridan as well.
Yes, there was that.
Slippergate.
Slippergate. Are you listening, Henry's housemate?
But I think it's confusing because those trainers who's got that little teddy face on the front and the big nose, I think that it's quite easy that someone could confuse them for slippers.
That is true.
That's true, isn't it?
There's oversized
And I've
ones.
Also remembered, it wasn't you, it was Richard Spencer Powell, who's our art director. He's a married man with children, never goes out. We persuaded him to come out for a drink and he fell asleep on the tube and he woke up, I think, a £75 taxi journey away from his home.
Ouch.
That wasn't very good.
See, the perils. But now he could just ride up and down on the night tube till his heart's content, or till he woke up to get a stop.
Yeah, if he ended up in Crouch End, he could just come back again. Good.
Have we wound up back in Crouch End again before the show was out? I think we should wrap it up, Andrew. What do you say?
Let's thank, first of all, the show's producer, who is Fernando Augusto Pacheco, hence the Brazilian tune, which we pronounce very well. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond.
The Monocle Weekly will return next week, fear not. It'll be as sober and serious as this week's edition. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
It's goodbye.